You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show on Joy 1250.
Well, the very first time I chatted with Kathy Lee Gifford, it was a very warm and sincere moment. It was a long, long conversation, and we had a kind of a unique moment. I'm going to play that for you one more time, folks, because to me, I thought that Frank Gifford was going to come to my house and beat me up. That's exactly what I thought was going to happen. So have a listen to this. This is my first introduction to Frank Gifford.
Guess who just barged in as well and wants to say hi?
Who's that?
Frank Gifford. You got a minute?
I've heard of him.
Yeah, hold on.
Thanks.
This is Drew Marshall. You're speaking live to millions of people in Canada.
Hey, Drew, what you doing messing with my wife?
I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. I know nothing. I see nothing.
I come in, and my wife's on her knees. She's crying. She's like, what's going on? I'm crying. Saturday. Sun's out. It's beautiful.
Yeah, well, all I can say...
What you do, hon? Boy, you got some heck of a show.
Your wife is... how does she give so much and save for you?
I've never figured that out. I guess she takes it from me and gives to you.
Yeah.
I don't get much attention around here, really.
Yeah, well, let's keep going here. Tell me about the most embarrassing moment Kathy Lee has ever had in her life.
Well, I don't know. I just walked in here and it was pretty embarrassing. I couldn't figure out what she was doing.
On her knees.
Something's really going wrong somewhere.
That's right.
I was sweating buckets. I thought for sure he was going to hop in a plane and come up and thump me. Frank Gifford, Pro Football Hall of Fame inductee and author of The Glory Game, How the 1958 NFL Championship Changed Football Forever. I'm not sure if you realize this or not, folks, but that 58 National Football League Championship game between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts is often referred to as the greatest game ever played, and it remains the single most memorable contest in the history of American professional football. Broadcast nationally to an audience of millions, it was the first time a title game ever went into sudden death overtime. It had all the drama, excitement, controversy, absolutely riveting the nation, and actually helped propel the NFL into the forefront of the American sports landscape. Celebrating the game's 50th anniversary, one of the key players in that mythic battle, New York Giants Hall of Famer and longtime television analyst Frank Gifford, provides an inside-the-helmet account about this moment that is going to go down in the annals of sports literature. Like, I wasn't born at this particular point in time, but I'm still hearing people talk about this game. So joining us to talk a little bit more about it is the man himself, Frank Gifford. Frank, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Who wrote that for you?
I don't know. It was just very well done, though, let me tell you.
And who wrote that beginning part?
My wife. Oh, my. Seriously, I was terrified. You came on the phone and scared me to death.
Why would I scare you?
I don't know, because you're a tough son of a gun. That's...
No, not really. I'm rather mellow. where are you located, Drew?
Well, we're in Toronto.
That's what I thought, yeah. Kathy said you're like the biggest thing in Canada.
Oh, I am.
I said, how big is that?
Yeah, how big can that really be anyway, yeah. Hey, can you do me a favor and tell us the story of how American Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author David Halberstam really kind of wrote this book?
Well, it was a little different than that. David, I knew from, he had a home in Nantucket, and we have a home also in Nantucket, and he was interested in a lot of things, and I was interested in him. I found him to be a fascinating person. I got to know him quite well, and he was working on a book about Korea, The Longest Winter, and he was really so deeply into it, and I was talking to him one day, and he said, why don't I do something light? And he said, I'll do a book on how about Bill Belichick, who was hot at the time. And, of course, everyone was, Bill was in the news for a lot of things about how difficult he was. And so I kind of laughed. But Bill was a good friend of mine, and still is. And so I put them together. He wrote a book about Bill Belichick. It was a great book. And we were talking about it, and we started talking about the 58 championship game. And a lot of people referred to it, has been over the years referred to, as the greatest game ever played. So he told me that he'd really like to do that, and would I help him locate some of the players? And long story short, I did. I knew where a lot of them were because we had a couple of reunions, but I found some of them that were in obscure places like Iowa and up in Northern California and in Oregon. And I finally had them all located, and I got a call one afternoon, and he was out and speaking at the University of California, and he wanted to go over and visit Y.E. Tittle. I said, well, he didn't play in that game. And he said, well, I want to talk to him about the whole Giant philosophy and what it was that brought you. A long story short, he was driving over to see Y.A. Tittle for an interview that I'd set up. And He was killed tragically in an automobile accident, and it really shattered me. Number one, that I was involved in it. Number two, he was a great friend at that point in time. And number three was the last part of it was that he was going to do this book. And so, again, long story short, I decided I'd do it myself. I had all the names. I'd made all the contacts, and the guys were waiting to talk to him. And so I went ahead and did it myself.
17 players from the Giants, 18 from the Colts. I would imagine the majority of the boys just came to live ordinary lives. Very few would have gone on to the sort of celebritydom that you did.
Well, I was the only one that really stayed in New York. Well, with Kyle Rowe, we did. Kyle, of course, went into radio like I did, and then later I went into television. And Kyle had a rather tragic ending to his life, and a great friend. I think I pointed out in the book, so many of the players actually named their sons after Kyle. I mean, he was such an admired person.
Wow.
On the team, and I write a lot about him in the book. But you're right about that. I stayed in touch with him, and they kind of followed me because I went out of football and as a player, and I went into broadcasting first with CBS on television, and then later on Monday Night Football for 27 years. And the guys kind of kept track of me. As I wrote in the very beginning of the book, I'd fly over the country after having done a game in San Francisco or San Diego or taking what we call the red eye back to New York. And I often would look down and see these lights and wonder about all the guys that I'd played with over the years. And of course, I'd have a couple of vodkas, and it would get even a little more interesting. I kept in touch with them, and I was sort of the conduit for all of them because I was still in the game, and I'd get a call from, say, Al Berry, and he'd wanted to know if I'd talk to Bob Piviani or something like that. And so I'd say, yeah, well, I know he's out in Oregon, and I'd put him together. And so that's kind of how it worked, and I kept pretty close contact with a lot of them. But, of course, when I got ready to do the book, I really got to know some of them and how troubled they were and how their lives have been had so many difficulties in them, and so many of them are having medical problems. And, it was a journey that I would not want to do again because there were at times it was very exciting and exhilarating, and other times it was very sad and tragic.
Well, I was going to say, you've said that so much of your personal life was exposed when you started remembering what you were doing.
Exactly.
50 years ago. So was that sort of cathartic for you, or is it troublesome?
A little bit of both. And it was a wholly, entirely different life. And I had a different family. My kids are younger than my grandchildren, Cody and Cassidy. And so I lived what you would almost call a complete life. My former wife passed away a number of years ago, but my kids are still around, and they're my older kids know my kids.
Man,
it's sometimes difficult to explain, but but when I started to write about it, I was reliving that life that I had already lived.
Yeah,
and you're right; it was cathartic, is a nice way to put it.
You know, I cannot believe that you had Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry as assistant coaches.
Mm-hmm.
That's just insane.
A lot of people didn't realize that they were actually. Tom Landry was just retired as a player coach in 1958, and he was coaching just the defense at the time. That was before the Dallas Cowboys even existed.
Yeah. It was also before they had a coaching staff of, what, 24 today?
That's what it is. I counted them. And the Giants actually have 24 assistant coaches. I mean, that's counting the head coach.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any. I mean, we didn't even have a head coach. I mean, he just basically blew a whistle and said, "Are you ready?" And I'm speaking of Jim Lee Howell, and I'm not being mean or cruel, but he just knew nothing about football. He was brought in by the Maras when they fired Steve Owens after 23 years to kind of bring law and order to the team, and
right.
They were in desperate financial straits and all of that. But for somehow or other, Wellington Mara, who was the manager of the football team, he was the one who hired Vince Lombardi, and he was the one who elevated Tom Landy to a defensive player coach. So we had Jim Lee Howell who blew the whistle, and we had Vince Lombardi who did the offense, and Tom Landry who did the defense. And if you look in hindsight, both those coaches, Lombardi and Landry, are in the Hall of Fame as coaches.
Yeah. You know, you finished your football career in 64, I think, right?
64 is my last year.
Yeah.
I could have finished in 63, and I wouldn't have had to go through a horrible year when that was 64.
Well, I mean, Frank, I was born in 66, so I'm going to fully admit my ignorance about this game, but apparently your role in this epic battle wasn't exactly the best performance of your illustrious career.
Oh, you're being kind. Well, I point out in the book, which is called The Glory Game, by the way, published or picked that title. I just did not want to call it the greatest game ever played because it wasn't. And maybe it's something that I felt personally because I fumbled the ball twice. Had I not fumbled the ball twice, a lot of things would have changed in my life. Number one, I would have never met you because we wouldn't have been talking about the game.
Yeah.
Because we would have won very easily. because I fumbled once going in when we would have scored from inside the 10-yard line. And then I fumbled another time inside our own 20-yard line. And each one resulted, one kept us from scoring and one gave them a score. Pretty sloppy on my part.
Yeah.
I think there were five fumbles in the game altogether.
Well, and of course, this was the day the NFL gained a whole new crop of fans, primarily because of the game running into overtime.
Yeah.
I read in your book that there was a ton of confusion about what actually this overtime thing was.
Well, we didn't really know about it. I remember in the course of getting ready to do the book, I talked to Sam Huff a lot, who used to hate my guts because that was typical of the Giants' defense and their offense, and he didn't like me personally. But he and I have become really good friends, and we talked specifically about at the end of the game. We heard something about there was a kind of a rumble along the bench, and we may have to go to overtime. We don't know what the hell that was. Whether we come back the next day or what? But it turned out I remember Sam specifically, "What the hell do we do now?"
Man.
And so we went out and flipped a coin and started all over again.
Well, we're on the line with Frank Gifford. I know that you never want to be seen as that old football player who comes onto the field or into the broadcast booth and just complains about the way the game is today and how much better the Brotherhood was back in the day.
Well, I know better.
Yeah.
These guys who play today are so much better than we ever were.
But Frank, you must shake your head at some of the goings-on today in the game, both on and off the field.
Well, the thing I really don't like is, and I don't like it for what the message it sends to other little kids who play the game for fun, who will never become professionals or whatever. But I hate these guys who jump up and down and slap their chest and turn around and bow to the crowd. Some of the great, Vince Lombardi actually had, first time I ever heard it, these guys go into the end zone and they jump up and down and there's a victory dance and all of that.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying one time, "Why don't you act like you've been there?"
Nice.
And so every time I see this, I think, why don't you act like you've been there before?
A little classier.
A little. It just is ridiculous to me. And then the other things, I think they could, their lives could be a little bit directed. But again, I don't know. I have never lived that kind of a life where they literally have to, for some reason or other, they need bodyguards and they. And it has all, I think it has all to do with the amount of money involved in it today. I mean, these guys sometimes are making a single game what I made in a career.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, a couple things jump into my mind. I remember the last game I played. This is one of the main reasons I stopped playing ball was because of the hype. And I just got to a point in my life where I just went, this is driving me nuts. Shut your mouth and play the game. So I just, the other reason I stopped playing was because I had to share a helmet with a wide receiver.
how long did you play? Did you play in college?
No, I was, this is quite a boring story. I wanted to marry a girl from California and I didn't really want to work too hard. So I thought, gee, I should become a professional athlete. And so I thought, well, what do I do? How can I train by myself? So I started kicking footballs. I just kicked 300 balls a day and sprinted the field back and forth. And
yeah, I remember that. You told me this, yeah.
Yeah, tried out for Junior Tiger Cats, made the team, had tryouts with Ottawa, Toronto, and Hamilton, uh-huh. And then I finished off with NFL tryouts. Yeah, kickers camp down in Reno where I sat back and watched Louis Aguiar. You know you're in trouble when you're a kicker at a tryout camp and you're standing on the sidelines and you catch yourself with your jaw gaping, watching Louis Aguiar kick the ball,
mm-hmm.
Now,
some of these guys are amazing at what they can do. I mean, I never considered them players, but I've had a lot of them that have been good friends too. Pete Gogolak was a real good pal of mine.
Salary, size of the guys, the spotlight attitudes. Did the game go kind of showbiz with Joe Namath and his underwear commercials? Like after that? Is that the start of it?
No, I mean, it was heading in that direction. The thing that really did it, and it goes back really to 58, too, because when television changed everything.
Right.
And that was the first game that was actually televised. And, of course, it went into overtime, which meant it went in literally into prime time at various parts of across the country as the game grew later in it, and it went into, oddly enough, the game itself had a newspaper blackout in New York and was blacked out on television because that was the policy at the time. They never televised home games because they were afraid the crowds wouldn't come.
Yeah.
So it was blacked out in New York, but it was beamed all over the country, and television was just coming. I don't think the experts, if there were such a thing at the time, even knew the numbers of television sets that were in use. They had these imaginary numbers, of course, but I just know that it was far bigger than they ever estimated. Even to this day, it's amazing the people who remember this game.
Yeah.
Because, I don't remember the game that I went to 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I bet you don't either.
No.
And as a matter of fact, I said this to a bunch of Giant fans the other day when we were talking about it. I said, who did the Giants lose to 4 weeks ago? Blah, 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 blah. And they didn't even have a clue who it was. And I didn't either. But, that's the thing. This game has kind of resonated in people's minds because of the people that played in it, primarily because of Johnny Unitas, Raymond Barry, Sam Huff, Rosie Greer, Rosie Brown. These are names that are still big names in the world of professional football.
Of course, the book is called The Glory Game, How the 1958 NFL Championship Changed Football Forever. Frank Gifford on the phone with us, who I think made about $14,000. That'd be for the year.
Well, yeah, for the year. That was my salary.
Yeah.
The losing share was $3,500.
Wow.
We almost had a fist fight over that before the game as to how we were going to divide that. Which I document rather well in the book.
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine the boys these days squabbling about $2,000?
they pay the guy who takes care of their shoes that much.
Yeah. What was your off-season job, Frank?
I was actually already working in radio.
Okay.
And had pretty much focused on that. I actually when I was at USC, had studied acting and drama, and I was trying to decide. All I knew is I needed a job because I didn't make enough playing football to live off-season without a job. And I had worked in as an extra in a lot of films. I'd done a lot of stunt work, and it kind of led me into radio and television. I was doing a national radio show. I was filling in for Phil Rizzuto during the football season. And then I got my own radio show, and then pretty soon I was doing my own local TV show for TV sports. I actually started the whole world of TV sports on local news here in New York. I was the first one who ever did that.
I mean, you were quite the celebrity. How often would you be seen down at Tootsie's?
Well, anytime I wanted a free meal. Tootsie had a habit of picking it up for the jocks who came in there. He preferred boxers until we'd sold him on the world of pro football. Actually, it was a big boxing hangout for years. The book also is a classic about what New York was about. And I'm not saying it's a great city right now. I love New York, and I love what our mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, is doing to New York. He's turned it into a safe, great city again. It's just this last, yesterday with the day before yesterday.
With the plane.
This is a hands-on mayor. He was at the spot. He was comforting the people. He's a great mayor.
Huh.
And New York is coming back to what I felt it was at that time. And it was a comfortable city, a homey city, and a good place to be and a good place to live, and with a lot of good bars and a lot of good dives, and it worked. And it's working again.
The only thing it's missing is you and Babe Ruth and Frank Sinatra and Joe DiMaggio sitting at Tootsie's having a...
Well, nobody plays football in New York anymore either. They all play in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And one day maybe they'll build a stadium there. They're trying to build one. They get another huge one over in New Jersey. Now, I wish they'd build one right in the middle of Manhattan.
That'd be great.
How about Central Park would have been a great spot. It really would have been. It wouldn't have hurt anything.
Yeah.
This is a big area.
In 1959, you played Mount in Up Periscope with James Garner. Password.
That's where I got shot.
Yeah. You went from that to Password a couple times, I think.
I did a lot of Password. Yeah. I actually love that game.
You were good at it. I watched
it. I was really good. Yeah.
I watched a couple of clips on YouTube.
Yeah.
You're pretty sharp, you know, for a football guy.
Well, I don't like the way you put it.
To signing in as challenger as F. Newton Gifford on December 2nd, 1956 episode of What's My Line?
They didn't have a mask. Helen Gurley Brown, I think, was one of them. And I forget who the other was. But, I mean, there was a panel Password. They didn't even wear a mask, and that's how popular pro football. Imagine Eli Manning coming on. And if any kind of a panel, they'd know who he was.
Yeah.
But I mean, I came on as the most valuable player in the league, and I came on, and they didn't even wear a mask, and they tried to guess who I was and what I did.
From that to Jerry Maguire with Tom Cruise, the $6 Million Man, Spin City, All My Children in 1987, Coach, you even got on Captain Kangaroo.
I love Captain Kangaroo. I mean, that's a great show.
How did you miss out on playing the role tailor made for you, Frank, Tarzan?
You know what? I've actually was about ready to audition for that. I actually had worked on it, and I don't know what happened. I think I got a job in television or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, I couldn't swing through a tree or something. I don't
know. Yeah. And what happened to the Pilot Turnpike?
I have it. I really do. I mean, every now and then I can explain my career. I pull it out and show it to people.
Yeah.
An actor I was, although I did studied seriously, I really did, and studied with a great talent, an actor and director and everything. Win Hanman was his name, and a brilliant coach, and of course in the Dark Ages. But I mean, he's still a legendary person in that world. But I mean, it was not my. You know, I think probably, Drew, if I didn't have so many other things happening,
yeah,
I been forced to do that and put I have nothing but respect for people. I just saw a movie this afternoon with Leonardo DiCaprio. He's brilliant in that. I happen to know also the work and what they put into that. I mean, I was more focused on television. I was more focused on, you know, earning a living for my family. I wasn't ready to dump my world and give everything to that. And I sometimes wonder how successful I would have been had I done that.
Well, if that monster hit in 1960 against the Eagles had happened, say, I don't know, maybe prior to your 1956 MVP season, and it had kept you out of the game for good, where do you think life would have gone? Acting?
Probably, yeah, because it wasn't the concussion that I had that knocked me out for the season. That made me quit, because I did. I took a season off, and I went into television and radio, and I was very successful. I started doing a network radio show, and I had my local TV show. But I did that for 1 year, and I realized that how much I missed actually playing the game itself and the excitement of it. And I realized that if I stayed out another year, because I was 31 years old, if I stayed out another year, I could never go back and play again. But I could always do the radio. I could always do the television.
Yeah.
And so I went back and I played 3 more years, and I went back to the Pro Bowl in a different position, so it wasn't a stupid mistake on my part. And when I came back, I continued actually to do the radio and TV while I was playing. You couldn't do it today, but I mean, I could then, and I did what was my options at that time.
Frank, over the years of broadcasting, did you ever find that same chemistry you had with Dandy Don Meredith and Howard Cosell? Because you went through 11 guys.
Yeah, it's never exactly that. But I mean, you have to remember too, that was the beginning of primetime television in with football. And to, you know, now there are games on Monday, there are games on Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday, Thursdays, and you know, it's enormous. There were 12 football teams when I started doing it, and now there are 32. So I mean, the game has changed dramatically, and people, I know, I have a lot of people say, "Oh, man, it'll never be like that again." Well, yeah, thank God, because I mean, some of it was kind of hideous. I go back and listen to some of those games, and we weren't all that interesting, quite frankly.
Howard Cosell, what happened to him? Like, he sort of seemed to get really negative as the years went on.
Yeah, Howard got very bitter. He did something on the air one night and you know, people were just waiting to get to Howard. He was a very interesting man, a good friend of mine, very intelligent. He did a lot of good things. He stood up. He was very prominent in Jackie Robinson, getting him involved and bringing the black athlete to the forefront of all of professional sports, and he was very proud of that. We were doing a game in Washington one night, and he said something that was totally misconstrued. There was a black safety who was running back a punt, and I described the punt, and he returned it. I don't even remember the total, but it was, I think, close to it for a touchdown, like 60 or 70 yards or something. And then he came in with a color, said, "Look at that little monkey run." and I didn't think anything about it. I thought, "Oh my God." And I got my director, Chet Forty, came into my ear about 3 or 4 minutes later. He said, "You can't believe what's going on." And Howard, who, had been the champion for all black athletes.
Yeah.
All of a sudden was accused of being the bigoted and using the word in a racial context.
Yeah, yeah.
It was totally different. And it genuinely affected Howard. And I've never seen him like that. He was never again the same. And he was offended by the people that had turned against him all of a sudden. And it became a kind of a broadcasting joke. And it was very tragic. We stayed friends right to the very end. I went to see him right before he passed away. And his wife, Emmy, had been very ill, too. And,
right.
And he never did get over that.
Man.
And I tried to say to him, I said, "Howard, you know, everyone who I know who knows you knows what you really stand for." And he said, "But how could they do this to me, Giff?" And he literally felt the whole world turned against him. And it was so sad, because here was a man who really had championed the black athlete like no one had before him.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the whole world had turned against him. But they were waiting to do it. I mean, he was that New York nasal-sounding Jewish voice from New York that that people would hear on the radio and hear on television. And they were ready to. They knew he was intelligent. They knew he was bright, and they were ready to attack him for something. And they finally had the opportunity, and they really cut him off.
Well, the media is known for either building you up or tearing you down. One or the other.
Well, they'll do that.
Is this right? A regular Monday night football game would pull higher ratings than a World Series playoff game?
Oh, yeah. Remember a show called I Love Lucy?
Yeah. You bumped that.
Well, they moved that from Monday night, because
yeah.
The second year that we were on the air, we were getting astonishing ratings. We were into the 20s and close to the 30s sometimes.
Wow.
In ratings, and it was unheard of. And it was, the sets in use were different. If you really think about it, there were 13 channels. Today, they're about 800.
Yeah.
There's no way to count them today.
No.
You could buy movies, you can have anything you want on. But at that time, if you were talking television, you were talking like 13 channels.
You still go to all the Giants home games?
I go to all the home games.
You sit with Ann Mara?
I sit with Mrs. Mara and a lot of her grandchildren, some of her kids, and Wellington, of course, was a dear friend of mine, and as is the family, and I've stayed very close with them, and it's a different world. I go down on the field. I know some of the players, stay in touch with the coaches, and I get involved sometimes in multiple charity things that they have here in the city that the Giants are involved in, and I stay fairly close to, close to the commissioner, Roger Goodell, and so I was very close to Pete Rozelle and Paul Tagliabue, and every now and then they ask me an opinion on things. And I don't like to get into the celebrity side of it. I don't want any part of that, but I mean, I do treasure their respect for my feeling about the game.
You know, I this is going to sound like just a suck-up comment, but I fell in love with the Giants through Lawrence Taylor. He was a guy that I
great player.
I mean, unbelievable. And
a great person. He really was. He was a little racy in many ways, but gosh, I've never known an athlete like that, and to this day. The nearest thing would be Jimmy Brown, and Jimmy Brown, to me, was the greatest player ever played the game, and in terms of offense, and the second greatest would be if Jimmy Brown didn't play defense, it would be Lawrence Taylor.
Well, from Lawrence Taylor to following the Giants for a good chunk to the Giants stopping the Patriots and winning the Super, I mean, that was...
I had the opportunity to go there with my son, Cody, who is now at USC.
And he's taller than you now.
He's 6'3".
Man.
A lot of people remember Cody on television, but Cody is now 6'3", and he's doing great. But he and I were at the Super Bowl. We were sitting with Mrs. Mayer again. And that was, of all the games I've watched, that was just such genuine excitement. There was such drama at the end of it. And I've never done it before, but I went down with all those crazy fans on the field with my son. And
good for you.
And they'd come over they had Cody actually up on the stand, and he was holding the trophy, and it was an extraordinary, extraordinary night.
I don't want to let the cat out of the bag here, but before we say goodbye, 78 years old, would that be...
78.
Yeah. Looking back on it all, Frank, were there moments when you really recognized God's hand in your life?
Oh, God has been had his hand in everything I've done. I mean, you couldn't live my kind of life without understanding that. And it was part of growing up in my family, and they were very spiritual. And, of course, you know full well that Kathy is. So it's such a big part of our life, such a big part of our family.
Hmm.
I don't see how you can live the lives that we have lived without something stronger than yourself. Somebody who supports you and somebody who can carry you through the tough times. And it would be impossible, I think, to live not only my life, but Kathy's life. And to go through some of the things that we've gone through and some of the vicious attacks and some of the, not only the attacks, some of the acclaim and the acclamation that goes with and the glamour and all that. You need something that balances you out and something that stabilizes you. And I can't imagine doing that without my Lord.
Story I heard, and maybe I've got my facts wrong, but did you not give a copy of Lee Strobel's book to Evel Knievel?
I did, yeah, I do know that.
I can't remember who told me that, but I think it was when Evel had passed, because I was in the process of booking him on the show for an interview, and I think Christine might have mentioned to me that, she was the one that told me that he had passed.
Yeah.
And I was just shocked, and I think maybe Christine had mentioned this, but I can't remember the name of the book now. What was the name of the book?
Kathy gave it to me. I can't either. And she actually, Evel and I have been, I did most of his jumps, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And he and I got very close, and over the years we stayed in touch with each other. And then he started talking to Kathy, and pretty soon they were talking together on the phone. They were praying together on the phone, and all of a sudden, Evel himself came to know the Lord.
Hmm.
And in the last days of his life, I mean, he would call, and I'd talk to him for a few minutes, and he'd talk to Kathy for an hour. And he used to be my friend, but I mean, Kathy was a wonderful comfort to Evel.
Your life journey is unbelievable. It really is. I mean, not bad for a son of a driller turned Bakersfield driller with bad grades turned Phi Sigma Kappa USC.
Well, you've done your homework.
What a journey.
Yes, and it's still an interesting path ahead.
What's your favorite beer?
I drink a draft beer. I don't even know what it is. We have a draft in bed. I don't drink much beer.
But you have the nicest bar I've ever seen in my life.
You know that's the draft beer. You probably had draft beer.
Yeah, that's what I had. I thought it was very similar to a Bass, but anyway.
No, well, you know, everything we have a wonderful home, and I think you'll admit it is a home.
It is. It'd be very, very warm. Very warm.
That's Kathy. She's had a wonderful touch, and she's done some incredible things.
And I'm actually, I'm quite impressed that we weren't interrupted once by Kathy.
Tonight?
Yeah.
But I don't think she can't get on this line.
That's too bad. Oh, Frank, thank you very much for your time.
You know, it was a pleasure.
It really was. It was an honor to chat with you, mate.
And anytime, and God bless you.
You too, mate. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The best mother in the world, as Kathy Lee likes to talk about him. Next week, Kristen Chenoweth on the show, and Frank Schaefer, I think he's on next week. Might be the week after, but I think both of them are on next week. I don't know. I expected to know
You're
all this stuff.
You're just a guy on the show. That's all.
All right, we are out of here. Thinking not a moment too soon. Folks, if you're new to the country, please do me a favor. Stay out of the left lane. Bye-bye.